Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, it's really funny how sometimes the whole economy seems to turn on the fortune of individual Americans. Today is a great example. We learned we're not buying enough, so retailers are hurting. More of us applied for unemployment benefits last week, and those who are working are doing more for less. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. And by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 4th of September. Good to have you here. Maybe it's true what they say about bad things coming in threes, because they certainly did today for the economy. The first two are fairly straightforward. The big retail chains reported softer than expected sales last month. Discounters were the bright spot for a buying public looking for bargains. And first-time applications for unemployment benefits rose last week. Yes, that's a weekly number, so it's a bit volatile. This third one, though, does take some explaining. The second quarter of this year was a very productive one for American businesses. That's what the government said this morning. The Commerce Department also reported that labor costs actually decreased. That takes some of the air out of Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's bete noir, inflation. But it might also keep workers' salaries low. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
The Labor Department says productivity vaulted to a revised annual rate of 4.3%. This is not what the experts had expected. Chief Economist Chris Lowe at FTN Financial in New York says when the economy's in the doldrums, productivity usually falls.
What it tells you is that companies are wrestling with rising commodity prices, and they are tightening production in ways that they haven't in prior cycles.
Increased productivity will help companies rein in costs and help to steady inflation. But Lowe says those gains are coming at the expense of workers. Historically, wages rise with productivity, but labor costs were down. Business professor Peter Morisi at the University of Maryland says this time workers weren't invited to the party.
Most of the gains have been going to the very top of the economy, the large bankers, the hedge fund traders, and so forth. The workers are creating wealth, but they're not getting to share in it.
Fewer of us even have jobs these days. The ADP National Employment Report says private payrolls were down 33,000 last month. Morisi says workers without jobs can't buy a whole lot from all these productive companies.
Businesses should be concerned that workers are not sharing in improved productivity, because that's their consumers. Also, it's the morale of their workforce longer term.
Tomorrow, the Labor Department releases employment data for August. The forecast is for more job losses. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Shares of Boeing tumbled 4.5% today, part of a much larger slide on Wall Street. The company has what you might call an almost strike on its hands. Tens of thousands of union machinists could hit picket lines by Friday night if a two-day cooling-off period doesn't stick. And that would certainly mean lower productivity for a company that makes one of the most expensive single items in this economy, passenger airplanes. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman's been following the story. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Kai.
So what's on the table here that these two sides have decided not to talk about?
Well, the negotiators are back behind closed doors for 48 hours. Theoretically, they're listening to each other. But, you know, people who were listening to the union rally last night after 87% of the machinists voted to strike, and then listening to the company's statements, as I did, by a teleconference saying they'd listen but not really indicating that they were going to bring any new proposals to the table. It sounds like this is just a clock ticking toward 12:01 Saturday morning, when most people expect that the machinists will be on the picket lines.
This is not a time when unions in America have a whole lot of bargaining power, Mitchell. What is it that sets Boeing's machinists apart to think they can do this?
Well, you know, it's true that in the general economy, workers mostly can't handle a strike, especially a long strike right now. But Boeing and the machinists are really a breed apart in this economy. You know, first of all, the machinists are different. They're well paid. Their numbers have been rising in the Boeing factories, 7,000 new union members since the last contractor on the production lines. And Boeing is awash in orders. They have 8 years of backlogged orders for planes, something like 4,000 planes on order. They've got to make all those planes. The machinists know it. They're already working overtime, and they think Boeing can't afford to take a long strike.
But if airlines are going out of business all over the place as they are and having trouble paying for gas at $110 a barrel for oil, aren't plane makers, the company's customers, in trouble too?
You know, they would be if Boeing was mostly selling to American Airlines and Delta and United, but they're not. 90% of the planes they've got on order are not for domestic carriers that, you know, really are suffering. They're for All Nippon. They're for Singapore Airlines, Qantas, airlines in Eastern Europe and Russia. Those countries are beefing up their airline businesses. They've got more traffic. They're not hurting as much as the U.S. And down the line, they need to replace planes. They need to put more fuel-efficient planes in the air. And Boeing's business looks really good down the line.
Before I let you go, Mitchell, remind us when the strike deadline is.
12:01 Saturday morning.
Mitchell Hartman at the Entrepreneurship Desk in Portland, Oregon. Thanks, Mitchell.
Thanks, Kai. It was a pleasure.
Oil continued its generally downward ways today, or at least we think it did. Since crude started climbing last year, there's been all kinds of speculation about speculation in the markets. So the Commodities Futures Trading Commission has spent most of this year trying to figure out what's going on. Today, the Wall Street Journal reports that as part of its investigation, the CFTC is looking into whether oil companies have been manipulating prices themselves. The theory is that by reporting that their reserves are lower than they really are, that false shortage would force prices higher. From New York, Ashley Montite reports.
The Commodities Futures Trading Commission didn't have any comment on the journal's story. It would say only that its oil market investigations are ongoing. Tom Wallen is president of Energy Intelligence. He says what's certain is that the oil companies report their inventory levels to the government, which then publishes the numbers.
Every week when these numbers come out, they're watched by the market, and people in the futures market trade directly off of these numbers, and they make immediate assumptions about what the trend in the market is based on those inventory numbers.
So if the inventory numbers are low, traders buy and the price goes up. The oil company itself can then theoretically sell its oil for more than it would otherwise. Reporting inaccurate data to the government is against the law. Amy Myers Jaffe directs the Baker Institute Energy Forum at Rice University. She says the big oil companies already make billions of dollars producing oil.
And it's just hard for me to believe that the companies would engage in illegal activity to make a little bit of money. Why would they risk the scandal?
Tom Wallen is also skeptical. He says a company could under or over report and potentially move the market once or twice.
It would be very, very hard to do this in a systematic way. And it'd be inconceivable to me that this could be the cause of a sort of a major surplus in the price of oil.
He says the U.S.'s method of collecting this information is more thorough than that of most countries. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Slide might have been too gentle a word for what happened on Wall Street today. Train wreck would be good, I think. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The hurricane watch has shifted away from the Gulf Coast this week. Folks in Florida, Georgia, and up to the Carolinas are preparing for possible evacuations. That is, Tropical Storm Hanna approaches. And it is not good news for the many businesses that rely on late summer tourism. Earlier today, we called David Harper at the Rhett Art Gallery in Beaufort, South Carolina, that's just south of Charleston, to see what kind of emergency plans they have in place.
All the original prints, we would move to a location about 60 or 70 miles away. We're, of course, insured. So, you know, we're pretty much squared away as to what we would do if the storm hit here.
What kind of business do you do on an average September afternoon?
We probably do $1,500 a day.
And what's it been like for you this week as the storm approaches?
About $70 a day.
Bad weather is not always bad news, though. We've reached Todd Stratum in Holden Beach, North Carolina. He owns a construction firm there. Todd, thanks for talking with us.
Yes, sir.
What's this storm going to mean for you business-wise?
It'll be good if it's a bad storm because we'll get work.
What kind of work's that going to be?
Basically fixing roofs and siding and stuff like that that gets blown down.
What about as this storm gets ready? Are you the kind of person that people would call and say, listen, I need you to help me tarp down the roof or board up my windows?
Yeah, we have a lot of people calling and having us go check out their houses ahead of hand just to make sure everything's buttoned up before the storm.
Now, is that people who actually live there, or are you dealing with mostly rental properties?
About half and half. We have a pretty strong customer base of people we've been working for years, and half of them live here, some of them are out of town.
You're laying in supplies, I guess, to get ready to do this, all kinds of things from construction gear to tarpaulins and stuff. How much money are you shelling out to get ready to do this business before the storm?
Probably somewhere around like $500.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's just for taking care of stuff temporarily until you can really dig in and do the repair to stop the rain so you're not getting penalized by the insurance companies.
Tell me about the insurance company rules for getting things sort of in order after a storm.
After the storm, I think it depends on the insurance company, but it's something about like 36 hours or 72 hours that you have to have your roof basically tarped off so that no more damage can be done to the house, or the insurance company won't cover the damage that you originally got.
Yeah, so you've got some time pressure here too, huh?
Oh, yes. That's why we had the people call on immediately, trying to get first on the list so that their damage can be taken care of first, or at least taken care of for the insurance company.
Now, being in the business that you're in, I imagine it's not possible for you to evacuate and get out of the way.
I might have the family do it, and I might just go somewhere temporarily around the area just so I can get back to work real quick. But if it's a really bad one, you know, the family will get them out of town.
Yeah. Todd Stratman from Homestretch Construction in Holden Beach, North Carolina. Todd, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Here's today's Marketplace trivia question. The first one to get it right, as judged by the timestamp on the email, gets me doing the outgoing message on their home answering machine. Here you go. What's the official name of Social Security? I'll take a beat here while you think. If you need a hint, the acronym is OASDI, Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance. Most of us know about the old age and survivors parts, but there are about 7 million Americans who collect disability benefits from the Social Security Administration every month. Every year, another 2.5 million people apply, which brings us to the problem. There's a backlog of about 750,000 people trying to prove they deserve those disability payments. Later this month, Congress is going to weigh in on what to do about it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
When the Social Security Disability Program started in the 1950s, it was aimed at blue-collar workers with obvious injuries. Government newsreels described it this way.
Today, a new car comes off the assembly line every 48 seconds. These are the men and women who have Social Security protection in case sickness or accident causes a disability that is so severe that earning a living is no longer possible.
Today, a lot of people with hard-to-prove illnesses apply for disability benefits. They have lupus or chronic fatigue syndrome. Social Security sees them as borderline cases, so they're often denied. But once applicants get a chance to appeal to a judge, two-thirds of them win. If they lose, they can appeal again. That swells the backlog even more. Judge Robert Haberman hears disability cases in Roanoke, Virginia, and is an officer in the judges' union. He says the Social Security Administration is pressuring judges to just ram through positive decisions.
It solves a lot of problems by just paying a case. The individual claimant is out of the system. In other words, there are no appeals.
Haberman says those positive decisions could stack up to billions of dollars in wasted taxpayer money.
Well, I've heard that as a union line, but that's just not true.
That's Social Security Commissioner Michael Astru. Astru says he can't and doesn't tell judges how to decide cases. He says the problem is a shortage of judges and very uneven productivity. The Social Security Administration now encourages each of its nearly 1,200 judges to hear 500 to 700 cases per year.
We've had judges who decided no cases in a year, and we've had judges that have fairly chronically decided, you know, double digits, 40 cases a year.
All told, the judges hear more than 500,000 cases per year. But that's not enough to get through the backlog. ASTRU wants to up the number of judges and their productivity to eliminate the backlog in about 5 years. And ASTRU says judges aren't just ramming through positive decisions either. 46-year-old Karen Irardi can attest to that. At her hearing this year, a judge denied her disability benefits.
I just felt that he didn't understand it, what I've been through. And I don't think he had a lot of knowledge of the disease itself that I had been going through.
Irardi has rheumatoid arthritis, and so she was a borderline case. She had to quit her job as a substitute teacher in a suburb of Richmond, Virginia. Now she lives with her mother in a cramped apartment.
So hand me the cutting board.
Okay. Irardi and her mother have racked up thousands of dollars in credit card debt, paying for groceries and gas. Irardi still can't work. She's appealing her denial once again. So what's the answer? People with difficult cases like Irardi's want a fair hearing. Judges shouldn't take too long or feel rushed. Commissioner ASTRU has begun hiring more judges. The first group started this month. He's asking Congress for millions of dollars to hire a second batch of judges, but it's an election year, so it's not likely Congress will act anytime soon. Social Security claimants stuck in the backlog will just have to wait and wait and wait. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, the beginnings of search as we know it.
Do I remember life before Google? I do. It's vague, though.
But first, let's do the numbers. It was bad news and bears all over Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials plunged 344 points, 2.9% to close at 11,188. The NASDAQ sheared off 74 points, 3.2% to finish at 2259. The S&P 500 gave back 38 points. That is 2.9% there as well, closed at 1236. Higher jobless numbers and fears that the economic slump is worsening cratered Caterpillar. They unloaded 5.5% today. United Technologies scraped 3.75% lower. Financial stocks were slammed. Shares in Lehman Brothers forfeited more than 10% on news that the beleaguered giant might spin off $32 billion in commercial mortgages and real estate. Merrill Lynch retreated almost 7.5%. American Express charged off 5.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for August. It's not quite fall, but designers are looking ahead to spring at Fashion Week, getting underway in New York. And on September 5th, 1930, drivers Charles Creighton and James Hargis returned to New York after completing the first cross-country trip in reverse. They drove round-trip coast-to-coast backwards. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Listen, if you've got problems with your telephone service and you're looking for somebody to complain to, I'm afraid that's just too darn bad. The Federal Communications Commission is set to cut way back on how much information it collects from the country's biggest telecommunications providers, specifically information about service problems. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Hanna reports.
For years, the FCC has required phone companies to file reports on consumer satisfaction, network outages, and other problems. Tomorrow, that could all change.
The FCC is considering eliminating data reporting requirements for the biggest phone companies, simply because the biggest phone companies ask them to.
Chris Murray's at Consumers Union.
These accounts are how we keep track of how they're doing, and that information is simply going to be lost.
Right now, all this information is available online, and it's chock full of embarrassing tidbits about phone service. Want to know what companies' customers have to wait the longest to get a residential phone line? It's in there. And God help you if your phone goes out in Arizona. Fully one quarter of service reps in that state fail to fix the problem on their first trip out. Murray says this data helped regulators blow the whistle when networks were falling apart.
But at this point, it appears that the lion's share of the data are no longer going to be available to either regulators or consumers.
Some smaller phone companies are already exempt from filing reports. Their big rivals, like AT&T, Verizon, and Quest, say that makes the current system unfair. And they say all this information on quality is already collected in other ways. But consumer advocates and many state regulators disagree. And they worry that if the FCC stops collecting this data, it will become a watchdog without a clue. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
John McCain officially accepts the Republican nomination tonight in St. Paul. It's the most formal chance he's had yet to roll out his platform and tell us why he ought to be president. This week, we've been asking some prominent Republicans to tell us where they think the party hasn't been doing so well. Commentator and economist Glenn Hubbard chose health care. He says reform's going to have to mean some kind of government involvement.
Rising health care costs are draining consumers, harming the global competitiveness of American firms, and driving future federal budget deficits. Can the Republican Party succeed by keeping government out of health care? In a word, no. What we need to do is focus on getting more value for the health care dollar. Republicans propose leveling tax subsidies for health insurance bought through your employer or on your own. This change can reduce wasteful spending by tens of billions of dollars per year. But these reforms do not mean that government has no role. Subsidizing insurance for low-income individuals is obviously still important. And there's a big missing piece. If we move toward more individual markets, what about high-cost individuals? What about the chronically ill? Insurance markets provide good protection for unforeseen medical expenses, but they don't work well for persistently high-cost patients. Will market reforms leave them behind? And if reforms keep them in private insurance pools, must they raise the cost for everyone else? The simple answer is no. But we need to spend more federal dollars to jumpstart reform. Here's how. We should give subsidies to chronically ill individuals so they can purchase private insurance. The subsidy would provide partial coverage to an eligible person once health expenses exceeded a specified multiple of that person's area average expenses. That cost is still substantial, at least $5 billion per year to begin, but the cost is an essential down payment if we want market reform. If we pay the cost, the chronically ill will not be left behind by market-oriented health care reform, and insurance costs will fall for many Americans so more households will be able to afford insurance. Championing market reforms in health care to reduce costs to households and the government sounds good, but making the GOP's reform work will require a strong government role. In particular, some smart upfront additional spending on the chronically ill may be just what the doctor ordered.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the business school at Columbia University. He used to run the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. You can send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org, then click on the link that says Contact. Know it at the time, but 10 years ago this week, all of our lives started to change just a little bit. It didn't happen right away. The company responsible for it kind of snuck up on us the way a lot of things do in popular culture. But then at some point, you almost couldn't turn around without it being there.
I use Google for almost everything now. I use Google for email. I use Google Apps. I use Google Reader.
I use Google Earth.
Also, I use the maps.
Back in the fall of 1998, though, when Google was incorporated, it wasn't much more than a search engine. It wasn't even the only one out there. Everybody just thought it worked better.
Do I remember life before Google? I do. It's vague, though.
Well, I used to use Lycos.
I just remember I didn't like Ask Jeeves. I thought Ask Jeeves really sucked. So when Google came along, I was pretty excited about that.
Jeeves has taken leave. Now it's simply called Ask.com. Lycos is still around. Its shares aren't trading for $450 a piece, though. Google went public 4 years ago at what now seems like a bargain basement price of $85 a share and a promise from its founders.
Do no harm or something like that.
Google's motto is don't be evil.
Don't be evil is the motto? Interesting. Google's motto is don't be evil. Good.
The company made it into the dictionary 2 years ago. This is from Merriam-Webster's.
Google.
Verb. Transitive, to use the Google search engine to obtain information on the World Wide Web.
I Googled myself maybe 3-4 years ago, and it brought up some murderer in South America.
All right, so what you get on Google doesn't always match up with what you're looking for. But the point is, at least you can look. Whether that's good or bad is a different issue. A couple of months ago, The Atlantic magazine had this question on the cover. Is Google making us stupid? Not in the absolute sense, but in changing the way we think.
I expect to be able to instantly look up the answer to almost any question. And so I just no longer think of any kind of research as a daunting task. It's just made information unbelievably available.
About the only thing you can't find on Google is the actual date the company was founded. Some sources say the 4th of September 1998 for an incorporation date. Some say the 7th. So we did what you used to have to do back in the old days, before you could Google something. We actually called them up and asked. They said they take all of September as Google's birthday.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, another conspiracy theory around the high price of oil and gas. The National Insurance Crime Bureau has noticed something fishy. The Bureau says there's a striking correlation between the number of SUVs and trucks reported stolen and the rise in gas prices. Six of the top 10 vehicles on the list are guzzlers. But despite the fancy name, we're obliged to mention that the Bureau is funded by insurance companies, hence the stress on the word reported stolen, like they doubt it. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media today. The Dow fell 344 points. That's 2.99%. NASDAQ lopped off 74 points, 3.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 38 points. That is 2.9%. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, new entrepreneurs struggle with the down economy.
There is always the possibility that customers change. And once they start to change habits, it becomes tough to bring them back.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.